We move on now to final speaker. As we struggle through the Trump winterland, I welcome here the author of Hinterland. Any politician, UKIP, Lib Dem, Labour, Tory, is more interesting with an accompanying backstory. Kenneth Clark with jazz, Farage at the pub. But as Shakespeare said, ah, there's the rub. This man massages them all with a sting in the tail. He engineered and took part releasing the Birmingham Sith Six from jail. He knows them all, politicians that is, especially Tony Blair, and talking of him, no! I am lulling you into a stupor. Let him tell it. Welcome, Chris Mullin.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Every so often, I'm asked by a young aspiring politician for advice as to how to get on in politics. And my advice is always the same. It's undoubtedly the wrong advice, incidentally, but it's always the same. Do something else first, and then you might be useful when eventually, if and when eventually, you do get elected. And so Hinterland is the story of my life, only part of which involves politics. I studied law at university, but I was spending more time editing the student newspaper than I was studying law, so it seemed more logical to become a journalist. And I got a place on a scheme run by the Daily Mirror. Actually, it was down in Devon, but it was a sort of two-year apprenticeship, and then if you were lucky, they found you a job on one of their national titles, which in my case was the Sunday Mirror. And it was on the Sunday Mirror that I got my first lesson in how to compose fraudulent expenses. When I'd been there a week, I took my pathetic little expenses to the man who was supposed to verify their accuracy, and he declined to sign them on the grounds they were so low that they'd embarrass everybody else in the office. And so I just screwed it up and threw it away, and I went back to my desk. And then an old hand took pity on me, and he said, no, Chris, this is how we do it. You clean sheet in the typewriter. He said, right, you're up here from Devon, aren't you? I said, yes. This is 1970, incidentally, when the national average wage was about 21 quid a week. He said, you're up here from Devon, right, aren't you? Yes. He said, well, that's 7 quid a day, cost of living allowance. Seven sevens is 49. I said, what do you mean? We only work 5 days a week. He said, oh, I get you. You want to retain, you want to claim the return train fare at weekends, don't you? Anyway, he rapidly got it up into the 60s, and when he wasn't looking, I threw it away. 35 years later, during the great parliamentary expenses meltdown, I had a call from a journalist on the Sunday Mirror, and the theme of his story was clearly going to be they're all at it, which they weren't, incidentally, but that's another story. And I said, well, I'd only ever worked in one place where they were all at it, and that was the Mirror Group newspapers in 1970. He went away, and I never heard from him again. At the end of my apprenticeship, I was offered a job on the Sunday Mirror, which I turned down, and I paid £81 for a one-way ticket to the Far East. I reasoned that no one was ever likely to pay me to go and report the war in Vietnam, but if I posted myself there and worked backwards, there was a chance of scraping a living, which is more or less what I did for a while. I travelled extensively in China before it opened up, before Nixon visited, and I reported from the wars in Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia, and there's a chapter entitled Something to Write Home About, which covers that. There's a chapter about how I tracked down the survivors of the CIA's operation in Tibet. There's a chapter entitled Friends and Lovers. It's a short chapter, actually. It's an account of my disastrous early love life. There's a chapter entitled Good Morning Vietnam, about how I met my wife. She is Vietnamese, and she was born a refugee in a mud and straw house in Quang Nai province. And the story of her family, who became eventually quite prosperous, is remarkable. There's a chapter entitled My Brief Career as a novelist. I wrote three novels in the 1980s, one set in Vietnam, one set in Tibet, and the third one, which you might have heard of, was called A Very British Coup. They all actually sold options on the film rights, but A Very British Coup was the one that got made. Anyway, when we published the book in 1981, where politically the atmosphere was quite different from how it is today, and Tony Benn was at the height of his powers, and there was a lot of speculation, especially in the tabloids, about, you know, what do we do if there's a Benn government? I was coming home on the train from the Labour Party conference in Blackpool. I was travelling with Tony Banks, who was an MP for, or who became an MP for Newham, Peter Hayne, who later became a Labour cabinet minister, and Stuart Holland, who was already a Member of Parliament. And one of our numbers said, we were talking about how the establishment would react if a government led by Tony Benn did come to power. And one of our numbers said it would make a good novel. Whereupon Stuart Holland revealed that he, by the swimming pool in Greece the previous summer, he had tapped out the first four chapters of exactly such a novel. And Peter Hayne said, well, actually, he and a friend had just circulated a proposal to publishers proposing a novel along those. So I thought, well, I'd better get on with this. And so I did, and I worked on a little newspaper called Tribune at the time, and we used to, when it came out in 1982, we had an advert in the back of the paper for which we used to sell the book. And the first cheque for £7.95, which was then the going rate for a hardback, came in from the American Embassy. So we packed it up and sent it off and waited to see what would happen next. And the next thing that happened was I got an invitation to lunch with the minister at the American Embassy, the most important person after the ambassador. And so there came a day when he sent his bulletproof Cadillac round to Tribune's multi-story headquarters to convey me to his mansion in Kensington. And I thought, well, you know, there's going to be a lot of us round the table. This is no big deal. I wasn't even the editor of Tribune. Nobody had ever heard of me. But when I got there, it was just him and one of his officials and a Filipino butler and me. And I said, why on earth are you bothering with a minnow like me? He said, well, I reckon you're among the top 1,000 opinion formers in this country. So I said, well, I must be about number 999. He said, the other 999 have been here too. There's a chapter entitled Loony MP Backs Bomb Gang, which was the Sun's take on my campaign to release some of the people wrongly convicted in the big miscarriages of justice of the 70s and 80s. I had that framed on my wall at home. It's the whole front page of the Sun, actually. There's a couple of chapters on my move to Sunderland. I became the Member of Parliament in 1987 for Sunderland South. It's the one that you never had to stay up late to see the election out, because it was the first one. It was all done and dusted by 11 o'clock at night. There's two chapters there, because I'm an Essex man by birth, incidentally. But, of course, if you're born in Essex, you want to get elected as a Labour MP, you have to go a bit further north. The chapters of the local oligarchy were not that pleased to see me, I have to say, when I got there. So the two chapters on my time in Sunderland are entitled Deep North and Deep North 2, as in Jaws. There's a chapter on my brief and undistinguished ministerial career entitled A Little Light Governing. I was first appointed, I had three ministerial jobs. First was in the Department of Environment, Transport and the Regions, which was a massive department presided over by the Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott, who wasn't very good at personnel management. I put this as I put this as generously as I can. Anyway, when I'd been there a week or so, the Permanent Secretary came to see me, and he said something to me that I'd already worked out for myself, actually. Now look, Chris, he said, you're not going to be here long. And a vast department, eight ministers, you see, and I was very much at the bottom of the pecking order, he said, and you're not going to change very much, so think of two or three things where you might make a difference and put the rest to one side. Now, I'd already planned to do that. So among the issues I chose, there were three or four, was Leylandii trees. Do you know about Leylandii? Yes, of course you do. which are the subject of warfare in suburban Britain. And we've had people killed, I think. Certainly we've had people injured and lawsuits and God knows what. We used to get hundreds of letters about. And it only required, a very minor amendment to the planning law. So I thought, well, Lord alive, if we can't sort this out, we might as well all go home. Little did I know. No sooner had we consulted all those who had to be consulted, the solution was obvious, this minor amendment to the planning law, it just needed attaching to one of the many bills we had going through, when word came from Downing Street that the Prime Minister did not want any legislation on this subject. And so I said to the messenger from Downing Street, I don't believe the Prime Minister has spent more than 5 seconds on this subject. What is the problem? He said, Angie Hunter. Angie Hunter was a very powerful woman who was the personal assistant to the Prime Minister, although the title rather underestimated her influence. And she'd seen Rory Bremner on television the previous Sunday. He'd been doing a little skit, because Labour governments always get accused of being the nanny state. And he was doing a little skit on the nanny state, and one line in it was obviously, and do you know they're even trying to regulate the size of garden hedges now? Well, Angie had seen this, and she'd gone in and reported this to the boss. And New Labour lived in fear of Middle England and upsetting them. And so hence word came that we were not to legislate. So anyway, we had to consult all over again, and of course we came to exactly the same conclusion. There was no other way of dealing with it except. But instead it was decided to produce a leaflet advising for distribution in garden centres, advising people that it wasn't a good idea to plant 30 or 40-foot leylandite trees in suburban back gardens. And so there came a day when I was sitting in Michael Meacher, he was the Environment Minister's office, and a posse of officials turned up with the draft of this leaflet. And Michael read through it, and he said, where exactly, pure yes minister this incidentally, where exactly does it say that it's not a good idea to plant leylandite trees in suburban... Ah, minister, it doesn't quite put it as boldly as that. In fact, said one of the other officials, it could be taken to mean exactly the opposite. Anyway, we junked that. It took 4 years to sort out. I was long gone by the time it was. We attached a clause to the, which I hope has solved the problem, to the Antisocial Behaviour Bill. There's a chapter, an epilogue at the end, describing my life after Parliament. I've been reborn as a light entertainer, and I have a wonderful... I've acquired a walled garden in the north of Northumberland, which those of you who read my diaries will know was always my ambition. Well, I'm happy to say it's come to pass. In fact, one or two of you may have seen, we had a six-minute slot on Gardener's World last August. Now, that's fame indeed, eh? Yes. What have I learned in my almost 70 years on this planet? That happiness comes from doing stuff, not buying stuff. That no religion or ideology has a monopoly of wisdom. That anyone who claims to have found a perfect formula for human happiness is deluded. And that it's better to go while people are asking why rather than when. And on that note, I will sit down. Thank you.
For more information about the oldie, go to theoldie.co.uk. This podcast was produced by RadioGorgeous.com 2017.